Public Science Symposium, Avoiding Dangerous Climate Change, Geoengineering or Mitigation. My name is Martin Grant. I'm the Dean of Science of the Faculty of Science at McGill. And with that, I would like to first call upon Anthony C. Massey, Provost of McGill University and Professor of Sociology. Recently, Tony spoke passionately and proudly at the university's Senate regarding free speech, how university campuses are our society's home for the open discussion of controversial ideas and issues. I'm very happy he is here and willing to introduce tonight's symposium on controversial ideas and issues. Tony.
Thank you, and good evening. Actually, Martin Grant was pointing out that the difficult life of administrators at McGill when he said that I was the middle paragraph of his introduction. But I do want to thank all of you very much for being here. This is Monsieur Trottier, Madame Roussel, Mesdames et Messieurs. Je vous souhaite la bienvenue au cinquième symposium public en sciences Laurent Trottier pour éviter le dangereux changement climatique, ingénierie de l'environnement ou atténuation. McGill University has a long tradition of hosting public conferences to stimulate awareness of the state of scholarly investigations in a variety of domains. As provost, which is the vice principal academic or the person responsible for the academic mission of the university, I have the opportunity to welcome many audiences to McGill and to encourage them to listen, to think, and to participate via questioning. Given the sheer number of such occasions on our campuses, however, I cannot always attend, but every year for the last 5 years I've cleared my schedule to be present for this event. So it is with great pleasure and honest enthusiasm for the initiative that I extend to you McGill University's warmest welcome for this, the fifth annual Laurent Trottier Symposium on Real Debates in Science. At McGill, there exists an elite set of prestigious visiting speaker series, the Beattie Lectures, the Burke Lectures, the Millennium Lecture Series, and several others. But the Trottier Symposium on Real Debates in Science stand out for their scope, their breadth, and their depth. Over the years, these symposia have taken us from the origins of life to the evolution of ethics, and now this evening's discussion on how to respond to the world's changing climate. On behalf of McGill, I wish to convey the deepest possible appreciation to Laurent Trottier and the Trottier Family Foundation for having funded this wonderful and exciting speaker series. It is a distinct honor for this university to acknowledge the many contributions made by the Trottiers and for the considerable opportunities that such generosity brings to McGill. Indeed, it would be a gross understatement to call Laurent Trottier simply a friend of McGill University. He is a two-time graduate of McGill's Faculty of Engineering and is a founding partner of Matrox Electronic Systems. The beneficence of the Trottier family is among the most generous in the history of McGill and numbers in the tens of millions of dollars. The Laurent Trottier Information Technology Building, which was dedicated in 2004, came about thanks to a $10 million gift. Then in 2006, we received a second, even more generous donation of $12 million to establish the Laurent Trottier Chair in Astrophysics and Cosmology in the Faculty of Science, the Laurent Trottier Chair in Aerospace Engineering in the Faculty of Engineering, and associate fellowships for graduate students in both faculties. In 2007, the Faculty of Engineering awarded the first Laurent Trottier Engineering Graduate Fellowship recipients. The Trottier Family Foundation also sponsors this symposium annually at McGill. This series was created to hold a public forum to inspire debate and raise public awareness on contemporary issues that are confronting society today. By the way, Mr. Trottier, in addition to those other gifts, never forgets McGill's annual fund. So it's a role model for all of the alumni and alumnae in the audience tonight. Laurent Trottier is a man of vision who, recalling the great tradition of the 19th century Grand Salon, has challenged McGill to create a forum for public debate and discussion among 21st century scholars, scientists, and intellectuals. in order to make serious and profound scientific debates accessible to a wider audience. On behalf of McGill University, I would like to thank the Trottier Family Foundation for sponsoring the event. McGill is happy to be hosting a discussion of one of today's biggest challenges, how to understand and deal with climate change. This evening's panelists, who will be introduced to you shortly by Professor Nigel Roulet, will, I am sure, provide a considered, intriguing, and challenging set of perspectives on how we can attempt to avoid dangerous climate change. There is no shortage of issues to sort out this evening, and I am sure that the Trottier Symposium will cast much light on the debate about geoengineering and the possible mitigation of the effects of climate change. I now call back on Dean Grant, not the middle but the last paragraph of my speaking notes, to introduce Nigel Roulet. Ladies and gentlemen, à tous nos invités, je souhaite un symposium aussi instructif que fascinant. Merci. Thank you. Dean Grant.
As I get to the last paragraph of my remarks, that will be the last speaking by an academic administrator tonight. I will now turn the symposium over to our capable moderator, Nigel Roulet, who is James McGill Professor of Geography. Amongst other accomplishments, Nigel is a contributing author to the second through fourth scientific assessments of climate change by the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And so, he is well suited for the demands that we place upon him tonight as moderator of our debate. And with that, I pass it to Nigel.
So it's my pleasure to introduce the Lauren Trottier Symposium this year. In November 2005, we actually did the first Lauren Trottier Public Symposium, and it preceded the 11th Conference of Parties to the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change that was held here in December in Montreal. I moderated that event. I can't remember exactly what the title was that we used, but at that time it was Global Warming. I think it was Global Warming, What Can We Do About It, or something very close to that. Here we are 5 years later. Another Conference of Parties meeting is going to take place in Copenhagen in a number of weeks, and it's appropriate that we revisit this issue. There's now widespread agreement that human activity has caused a change in the composition of the atmosphere, and it's generally agreed that change of composition in the atmosphere is a cause of climate change. Observations suggest that the temperatures increased somewhere about 0.7, 0.8 degrees C over the last 150 years, and the latest assessment report of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change suggests that if we continue on the course that we're on now, we would expect to see temperature increases by 2100, somewhere in the order of 1.5 degrees to approximately 5 degrees C. There is a large body of literature that also suggests that these kinds of changes in climate will have a profound effect on society, including things like the global economy, security, and environmental resources, food, supplies, security, and water. The United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change commits the signatories to, they agreed to, stabilizing greenhouse gases at concentrations in the atmosphere at a level that would prevent dangerous anthropogenic interference to the climate system. The issue about dangerous climate change, or what dangerous climate change is, has never really been defined, but it's generally agreed amongst climate scientists that it's somewhere around about 2 degrees C, and that represents somewhere a change of about 400 to 500 parts per million of CO2 or CO2 equivalent in the atmosphere. We are currently at 387 parts per million, and we are increasing at the rate of a little over 2 parts per million. We've done that for the first part of the decade of this century. There are essentially three strategies to reduce the risk of climate change. By far, the preferred option is mitigation through the reduction of greenhouse gases and reducing and attempting to stabilize their concentration in the atmosphere, and preferably reduce the concentrations. Given that the emissions we've already done and the commitment that we have to the concentration of CO2 gases in the atmosphere, we are also going to have to learn how to adapt to a certain amount of climate change. It's inevitable. It is going to happen because of what we've already done. A third option that might mix into this policy, or policy sets of policy, is geoengineering, and that is the deliberate manipulation of the physical, chemical, and biological aspects of the Earth system. Broadly speaking, geoengineering approaches can be divided into two. One is the removal of carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, and the second is the management of incoming solar radiation. The idea of geoengineering has been around for quite a while, but it really began to take off after Paul Crutzen of the Max Planck Institute, the 1995 Nobel laureate in chemistry, and Tom Wigley of the National Center for Atmospheric Research suggested geoengineering might be in the policy mix to be able to handle the issue of climate change, given the lack of progress that was happening on reduction of greenhouse gases. This stimulated a considerable debate and a number of articles on geoengineering, of which many of our panelists have actually taken part in. In September of this year, the Royal Society of London released a report called Geoengineering, Climate Science and Governance, The Uncertainty. One of our panelists was actually an author in that report. So we've assembled these panels of experts to be able to enlighten us on the issue of geoengineering, some of the questions that relate to geoengineering, and some of the issues related to how it could be implemented or whether it should be implemented in these various different things. I'd like to introduce the panelists now in the order that they are going to speak. The first speaker will be David Keith, who is the Director of Energy and Environment Systems Group at the Institute of Sustainable Environment and Economy and also the Canadian Research Chair in Energy and Environment at the Department of Chemical Engineering in University of Calgary. It's quite a mouthful, David. His research has been at the interface between climate science, energy technology, and public policy. He has worked on technology and policy assessment on the capture of CO2 and storage, the technology and implications of global climate engineering, and the economics and climate impacts of large-scale wind power and prospects of hydrogen fuel. He first wrote an article on geoengineering in 1991, and he wrote a major review paper a number of years ago. He was one of the authors of this report from the Royal Society. He's received many honors, and he is listed as one of Time Magazine's Heroes of the Environment for 2009, and he is a recipient of the Canadian Geographic Environmental Scientist of the Year in 2006. The next speaker will be James Fleming, a professor and director of science and technology and society at Colby College, Maine. Professor Fleming's main interest is the bridge between the history of science and technology, especially the geophysical sciences of meteorology and climate change. He held the Roger Revelle Fellowship in Global Environmental Stewardship for the American Association for the Advancement of Science, the AAAS as it's known, and the public policy scholar at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. He's published extensively, and I highly recommend his book on the historical prospect of climate change that was published by Oxford Press in 1998. He's also releasing a new book that's coming out, I believe, early next year. It's called Fixing the Sky, the Checkered History of Weather and Climate Control. And if you Google the name Professor Fleming or James Fleming, you'll actually get his November 5th, 2009 testimony that he did before the U.S. House of Representatives Committee on Science and Technology. Our third speaker will be Alan Robach, who is the Distinguished Professor of Climatology in the Department of Environmental Science at Rutgers University and Associate Director of the Center for Environmental Protection. He also directs Rutgers' undergraduate meteorology program. His areas of expertise include impact of climate change on human activities, detection and attribution of human effects on the climate system, regional atmosphere hydrology modeling, soil moisture variations, geoengineering, and climate effect of nuclear weapons, and the effects of volcanic eruptions on climate. Two of his most recent articles actually stimulated considerable debate in the area of geoengineering. One was titled 20 Reasons Why Geoengineering May Be a Bad Idea, published in the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, and Wither Geoengineering, which was published in the Journal of Science. Both these came out in 2008. He has also received many honors and is a fellow of the American Meteorological Society and a fellow of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. Our final speaker will be Phil Raich, who is the chief scientist from the climate scientist and a laboratory fellow at the U.S. Department of Energy's Pacific Northwest National Laboratory. Until 2008, Dr. Raich served as a senior scientist in the Climate and Global Dynamics Division of the National Center for Atmospheric Research in Boulder, Colorado. He is internationally renowned for his work on climate modeling and atmospheric chemistry. He has held several editorial positions for international journals and on advisory panels for the National Science Foundation, the U.S. Department of Energy, and NASA. Dr. Raich has just completed a term as the chair of the International Geosphere Biosphere Program Activity in Atmospheric Chemistry. Three of these panelists served also on the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change that the dean mentioned. So the way we're going to proceed through the rest of the symposium is that each of our panelists are going to give a set of opening remarks of which they are being timed for, that they are going to get finished in the proper amount of time. They know what the time is, a short set of remarks. Then after that, we will follow it with a session of question and answers amongst themselves, a discussion about particular points that they would like to raise. And then after that, we will open the floor to the public for questions, and we plan to conclude by 7 p.m. tonight. So with no further ado, I call on our first speaker, which will be David Keith.
Thanks very much. It's really a treat to be here. Thanks very much for the kind introduction. I'll start by saying some of the kind of standard stuff you've heard about climate change, try and illustrate to you why I think it's a really serious problem, but I hope to do it in a slightly novel way. And then I want to focus on the fact that I think the key attributes that make it a dangerous problem in a way are the combination of uncertainty and inertia in the climate system. And I want to really take issue in a way with the green primer that's circulating around the audience, which essentially says that the reason to take geoengineering seriously is we can't get our act together and cut emissions. And I think that is really certainly not the reason I take it seriously and not in the right framing. So we've all seen, you know, hideous pictures of machines belching smoke, and they do. But it's useful, especially if you're a scientist like me, to try and put this in some sort of simple numerical terms, to think about just how big an impact we really are on the planet. You want a simple ratio. How does this impact that we're doing compare to natural processes? You've got to think, what's the right natural process? What we're doing with fossil fuels is digging carbon from the geosphere and putting it into the active ocean and atmosphere. And so it turns out the rate at which we're doing that is not 5% or 10%. It's something like a factor of 30 times the natural rate. So if you have some idea that we are a small impact on this planet, you just don't have the right facts. We are an enormous impact on the planet. A factor of 30 is a huge impact. We're completely overwhelming the natural carbon cycle in this long timescale sense. Another way to look at it is to look back over the last 50 million years or so. Back in the Eocene, we had CO2 concentrations, as we measure them, of about 1,000 parts per million. And back there, we had a very different climate. We had alligators in the high Arctic, and that's not a bad thing. So if human civilization had evolved then, that would be what we were used to. There's nothing intrinsically bad about climate change. But if we keep doing what we're doing, we will bring the CO2 concentrations back to that level in my children's lifetime. It took us 10 million years for the CO2 levels to decline after that. We're talking about doing that 100,000 times faster. So people on my street in Calgary who tend to disbelieve the climate science will routinely say, oh, this climate changes naturally all the time. Yeah, sure, but the issue is timescale. Doing something over 10 million years is very different from doing it over 100 years. Not that we'll get exactly that much climate change, but this is a sense of the scale. So the two key things to say, I believe, about the climate problem, which are also related to geoengineering, are first of all, the amount of climate change we're going to get for a given amount of CO2 emissions is deeply uncertain. This isn't a statement of a climate skeptic. It's a statement of the core uncertainty in our ability to predict how much climate change we get. This is nicely illustrated by these roulette wheels the MIT group puts out. And we're going to spin the roulette wheel. We are spinning it whether we like it or not. And we could get lucky and have not very much climate change or a lot. And we don't know which it's going to be. And no amount of better scientific effort is going to deliver us an answer before we actually see the effects. So it's uncertain, and there's an enormous amount of inertia. CO2 lasts, we all think nuclear waste lasts for a long time, and it does, but by some measures, you can read my slide, CO2 lasts longer, the imprint of CO2 on the biosphere lasts longer than nuclear waste. It's that combination that's particularly dangerous. Think about the combination of inertia and uncertainty. Let's say we actually had policy. Right now what we have is talk about having policy, and that's not just a statement about Canada. The world generally has agreed to have symbolic actions on climate change and essentially no real actions. Even in Europe, where we think that people are doing a lot, they're building uncontrolled coal-fired power plants. And if there was a single thing you would actually do, if you were actually serious about dealing with this problem, you wouldn't do that. So at this point, the whole world is really at the talk stage. But let's say you actually began to do something. You'd build low-emissions infrastructure to replace high-emission infrastructure. You'd gradually build up a stock of low-emissions infrastructure. But just a stock of low-emissions infrastructure doesn't solve the problem because of the inertia. It reduces emissions. That's the amount we put out each year. But it's concentrations, the amount of CO2 in the air, that's the ultimate problem. And that's the sum of emissions back over time. So we have this enormously inertial system. If we stop emitting all CO2 emissions today, we still have the problem. Very unlike conventional pollutants, like, say, sulfur dioxide, where if we stop the emissions, the air gets cleaner in a few days. So it's that combination of uncertainty and inertia that presents the central danger of the climate problem. By the time we find out how bad it is, if we find out that the roulette wheel spins in the unlucky place, we'll already have enough CO2 in the air that we'll have substantial risk, and no amount of cutting emissions will save us. So this is not an argument that we shouldn't cut emissions. We must cut emissions. I'm going to argue that clearly later. But it is an argument that I think the way this primer is phrased doesn't get it right. This is not a choice between these two things. They're complementary, different ways to manage the problem. But there are some versions of the problem where no amount of cutting emissions will solve it. So geoengineering, as you can see, is this thing in the middle that's neither mitigation or adaptation. And again, as you heard in the introduction, there are two completely different kinds of things, and essentially all we're talking about tonight is this fast-acting thing, this thing that is fast, cheap, and imperfect. And I'm going to illustrate why it's fast, cheap, and imperfect and what the consequences of being fast, cheap, and imperfect are. There's a separate class of things that you see on the right, which are ways we could remove CO2 from the atmosphere. Those things have very different character. In general, they actually get at the root problem in some way, depending on how you want to define the root problem. They cause their own local environmental problems like anything we do, but they are inherently slow and expensive. And what we're talking about tonight is the fast stuff. Neither our knowledge about the climate problem nor about geoengineering are new. And Jim will tell you more about this, but I think it's important to take some kind of historical perspective. The biggest thing that changes our attitude to these things, which is, in many ways, it changes in a healthy way. Most of you probably have a kind of ick reaction to the hideous idea we're going to put pollution in the stratosphere to try and compensate for pollution in the main part of the atmosphere. But this is the report that got to President Johnson's desk when I was 2 years old, and it says exactly what you need to know you have a serious climate problem and you should do something about it. And we've done essentially nothing since then. And also it says, as a solution, that we should do geoengineering, which is not an endorsement that geoengineering is the right or wrong thing, but it just gives you a sense of how old these topics are. So now let me illustrate the statement about cheap, fast, and imperfect. This is the thing I want to emphasize is it's not cheap because some fancy study says it's cheap. It's cheap for some underlying simple reasons that are not likely to go away, that have to do with moving mass around. So if you want to alter, if you want an ice age, you want to cool the planet down a lot, you can do that with fluxes of mass of something like 150 kilograms a second into the stratosphere with the right kind of particles. That's just twice my weight, roughly, every second in the stratosphere, which is tiny. Whereas if you wanted to, in a relatively short amount of time, take CO2 out of the air to make a change, you need something like 2 million kilograms a second. And that underlying difference is the underlying reason why it's just intrinsically cheap to put a bunch of material in the stratosphere. This is a statement that it's good, but it's a statement that it's so cheap that this won't be a cost-benefit decision. It's so cheap that the money for doing this won't be a central piece of decision. This will be a risk-risk decision. There will be risks about doing it and risks of not doing it. It's also fast. We know, and you'll see some data later, that if you put reflective particles in the, if you reflect some more sunlight, you put reflective particles in the atmosphere, the Earth gets colder within a year, and we know that from volcanoes. The volcanoes also tell us lots of bad things about the outcome, but we know it's fast. And finally, we know it's imperfect. Maybe imperfect sounds like salesmanship, so we should call it ineffective. I'm happy with either name. But the point is that cooling the planet by reflecting away more sunlight cannot ever compensate completely for putting CO2 in the air. They just are different ways of pushing the climate system around. They do not do the same thing. So while you may partially compensate by cooling, by reducing the amount of sunlight absorbed, you cannot completely compensate for some pretty basic physical reasons. Here gives you a sense of that imperfect compensation, and so I just want you to look at one of these things. This shows you the change in temperature and precipitation as you increase the amount of geoengineering in a climate model simulation. So if you look at that line of dots that says China 2070s, what happens when you increase the amount of geoengineering is you take it from a world where, without geoengineering, you get a lot warmer in China in the 2070s in this particular model, to a world where you don't get much warmer, but the precipitation goes down, you get drier. Whereas in India, you get a different effect. Like lots of other things about climate change, this is going to be patchy. Not everybody will suffer the same way. I'm going to skip over some of these because I'm slow. I want to say the following things. Almost all work on geoengineering has assumed that the way we're going to do it is to put a sulfur gas in the stratosphere, which is roughly what volcanoes do, sulfur dioxide or something like that. And these are some early modeling results, which, like any modeling results, might be wrong, that suggest that this won't work very well. And the reason is that when you put a gas in and it wants to condense to form solid particles, it mostly condenses on the particles that are already there and makes bigger ones, which turn out to be very ineffective for doing geoengineering, and they fall out. And so what this graph shows is as you increase the amount of sulfur you add on the bottom, you get an asymptotic effect, where adding an additional amount doesn't help very much. And so you have to add a huge amount to have much effect. And this illustrates, in a way, how primitive our knowledge is about this topic. I and my colleagues think we have, at this point, interesting a way around that, but that, again, is primitive knowledge, a few model experiments. There's nothing deep, no deep knowledge here. So let me frame a thought about how to think about the value of doing some research. We have, essentially, no serious scientific effort to look at geoengineering. We can talk about why that is in questions. There's now serious debate about doing that. I think we should have a serious scientific research effort that goes right to experiments. And let me give you one framing as a dichotomy, which, of course, it isn't a dichotomy. It's more complicated, that might capture why I think that's true. So let's say that geoengineering either works or doesn't. Of course, it won't be that simple. And let's say we either think it works or it doesn't work. So I'd say the very worst situation to be in is that if we are confident it works, but it doesn't. If we're confident it works, we count on it, maybe we don't cut our emissions as much because of that, and then we find out it doesn't work. But we also don't want to be in some of those other boxes either. We wouldn't want to be absolutely confident it didn't work or have a taboo against it and find out later that it actually did work and we could have avoided some environmental damage that's serious. These, I think, underlying facts, that it's cheap, that it's fast and imperfect, have clear consequences. The fact that it's cheap means that the policy challenge is partly a challenge of controlling rogue actors. Unlike the challenge of getting most of the world to collaborate in cutting emissions, which we must do, and geoengineering does not get us out of that challenge, part of the challenge of geoengineering is it's so cheap that very small states or even the richest individuals could actually do something. And that makes it a very different problem in planetary governance, a very challenging one. I think, in a way, solving this problem will be one of the things that forces us to create a more serious system of planetary governance. It's fast, and the fact that it's fast means you can make decisions about how much to do after you find out how bad the climate problem is. And that way, it's quite different from cutting emissions. Different doesn't mean better or worse. It just means different. And finally, it's imperfect. And the fact that it's imperfect means that the strategy that says, if geoengineering is so cheap, let's not bother with any cutting emissions. Let's just keep emissions going forever while we geoengineer. That strategy will not work because this imperfection of geoengineering is fundamental. If you did that, you'd see increasing climate impacts no matter what. So a central reason why this has been essentially a taboo to talk about, why there's been no research, why many of us are scared, including me, and have been scared thinking about raising this when I began to raise it in the early 90s, is the following chain of argument. Knowledge that this is possible makes the climate impacts look less fearsome. After all, when I go into policymakers, cabinet makers, whatever, and tell them that we should do something about climate change, part of what I say is, look at this potential terrible things that could happen about climate change. But if I also say, yeah, we've got to get out of jail free card, then they won't take it so seriously. And this is, I think, a fundamental concern. This is actually not technically a moral hazard. It's really, from the point of view of economists, this is free riding on our grandkids. It's making their lives worse to make us richer. It's not absolutely clear that that will be the public reaction, but it's a central concern. So last slide, I think we need the capability to do this. We don't have to do it, because whether or not we have to do it depends on how bad the climate problem turns out to be. but we need the capability to do it in case the roulette wheel really runs the wrong way. We need, so because of this combination of inertia in the climate system and uncertainty, cutting emissions alone is not sufficient to hold climate change between a given level. You'll hear politicians endlessly talk about how we're going to hit a 2-degree C target. But given the actual uncertainty and how much the climate responds to CO2, we cannot be confident about doing that just by cutting emissions. Even if we cut emissions to zero today, which short of having an awful global war is not going to happen, we cannot eliminate the possibility of really horrific climate change. And every additional amount of a kilo of CO2 that we put in the atmosphere only increases that probability. But stopping it doesn't reduce the probability to zero. I think, it's my opinion, we need a serious research program to develop the capability to do it. And yes, I'm aware that developing capabilities has a bunch of institutional inertia that makes it more likely we'll do something, and we have to manage that, but I don't know another way out. I think that current understanding of the climate system and sort of current state-of-the-art climate model suggests that doing geoengineering carefully and intelligently, which doesn't mean whole hog, doesn't mean some of the foolish ways, could reduce climate risks. And finally, I think that the central questions are how to avoid this sort of natural trade-off that arises between geoengineering mitigation and how to engage with governance. Should we have a treaty? How do we govern the early experiments? Those, to me, are the burning questions here. Thank you very much.
Okay. James Fleming.
Getting the slides out? Okay, thank you. I'm delighted to be here, and I want to thank Laurent Trottier and all the good people here at McGill who made this such a pleasant trip so far. Looking forward to the rest of it. Geoengineering doesn't exist, and I'm going to tell you its history. And what I mean by that is that it's a speculation that's going on, that this might be something like a magic bullet. That was one of the points of the Royal Society's report. And I thought immediately, well, it shouldn't be a bullet at all. We shouldn't be shooting at the stratosphere. And so what I'm giving you is, as a historian of science, and I do have a considerable interest in public policy, I'm going to try to show you how history matters. It really matters a lot. And in facing unprecedented challenges, I think, as we are, with what do we do about climate change, I think we really need to seek for historical precedents. And I'll start with, a historian is allowed to tell stories, so I'm going to tell you a couple stories from different eras. The first comes from the European explorers and early American settlers and Canadian settlers who were surprised by the New World being much colder than areas of the same latitude in Europe. For example, Washington, D.C. and Lisbon, Portugal, same latitude. Montreal and Paris, France. Colonists worked to improve the climate by cutting the forests, tilling the soil, and draining the marshes. Benjamin Franklin thought this was possible. Thomas Jefferson thought it was actually happening. He called for an index of the American climate to document the changes being caused by human intervention. So what we're really talking about is a history of attitudes towards human intervention in which even our colonial people were thinking they could improve the climate if it wasn't suitable for their European-type settlement. This is going to be the cover of my book, Fixing the Sky, so it's time to do a little book plug for the artist. The artist was on the cover of Collier's magazine in 1954. And at this time, the quest to control nature was very active. This is an image of a technocrat, if you will, pulling levers of weather control. And the United States at the time was in a weather control race with the Soviet Union. It was a very different era. But an Air Force general spoke out and said, quote, "The nation that controls the weather will control the world." So this was really important stuff to get control over it before somebody else does. The magazine article inside of this had President Dwight Eisenhower's weather advisor, Harold Orville, providing details of how to fight weather warfare. And so this early 50s moment is really quite significant, I think, in providing some insight into the attitudes that sometimes we hold. I'll tell you a story that predates that by at least a century. And that is the first meteorologist that was hired by the U.S. government was named James Espy. And he worked for the U.S. Army Surgeon General, who proposed, at least, he was a distinguished meteorologist who came up with the convective theory of storms, that heated air rises and it rises, it cools, and it cools, it condenses water. So he thought he could make rain by lighting giant fires. He proposed cutting forests down along the Appalachian Mountains and torching them every week. He thought Sunday evening was a great time to do that. So he was actually, and literally, if you look at his writings, talking about making artificial volcanoes, or at least the effect of a violent, heated firestorm kind of updraft. And this would not simply be for weather control. It would trigger rain, but it would also eliminate droughts, it would eliminate hot and cold spells, and it would render the air healthy by clearing out the miasmas. Now, a popular writer at the time, Eliza Leslie, immediately pointed out that if this could be done, it would generate more problems than it solved, and it would lead to all the suspicion about who got the rain and who didn't. And manufactured weather would satisfy no one. So there are historical precedents, at least on the weather control scale. And I think weather and climate have a lot of commonalities. We'll go back to the 50s now. A year, in 1955, the noted Princeton mathematician, and you might have heard the name of Johnny von Neumann, who was involved in numerical weather prediction, among other things. And he wrote a popular article called Can We Survive Technology? He wrote that climate control through managing solar radiation, his words, was not necessarily a rational undertaking. In his opinion, climate control could alter the entire globe, shatter the existing political order, merge each nation's affairs with those of every other, and lend itself to forms of warfare not yet imagined, or conflict. He compared climate control in that article, I highly recommend it, to the threat of nuclear war, which was imminent at the time. This image goes to antiquity with Archimedes asking for a lever long enough to move the Earth, but he also needs a place to stand. And it seems that some are arguing that technology is providing that lever that will give us leverage over the planet. We're definitely at that point, probably inadvertently, but a purposeful lever. And I just cartooned a little bit, and I added a second slide to this, and I asked, where would it roll if it was tipped? And we know that the Earth is not a linear system, and we don't know what would happen if we had such a huge intervention. So if I had to declare in public, I guess this is public, I had to say I'm not in favor of such big leverage, technocratic, pulling the lever kind of images or activities. And so I'm much more interested in the uncovering the social dimension. I'm quoting Ron Prynne at MIT, who's in the Earth System program there. How do you engineer a system you don't understand? So I'm not against research for this. I'm just against research out of doors. I think it should be indoors between consenting adults. Well, some can argue that we can control the temperature of the globe. Ironically, I went to a NASA meeting on the topic of managing solar radiation, and the meeting coordinator apologized to us for not being able to control the temperature of the room. Just think about that. So I'm just telling stories, and if I run out of time, I won't tell one or something. But I find it amazing. Here's 1947. The military intervened in Hurricane King. The hurricanes weren't named back then, but they named this one King. And it was apparently going out to into the Atlantic, but when they seeded it with this dry ice seeding device, they kind of bombed it with a couple pounds of dry ice. It immediately turned in and devastated Savannah, Georgia. They canceled their press conference. They claimed that it wasn't us that did that. And later on, they showed that steering currents had actually brought it ashore. But this kind of intervention was pretty large scale. We still hear talk about redirecting hurricanes. And any redirected hurricane is going to be a trail of litigation along the path of that storm. Because which city would you rather hit and which city would be sacrificed? Langmuir was a Nobel laureate who kind of came into the atmospheric sciences with the big cloud seeding materials and proposed basically to go to the Pacific Basin over Bikini Atoll and seed the whole area in a way trying to generate a kind of an El Nino effect. So that is getting to the climatic level. He was talking about controlling the U.S. Weather on a seven-day basis. He was talking about maybe intervening in the whole Pacific Ocean. And then following up on this, there was another project in the 60s called Storm Fury, where we were, again, military airplanes, regular scientists working together with the military to try to intervene in hurricanes. And we got accused by Fidel Castro of diverting hurricanes to damage Cuba. One of the hurricanes came up the spine of Cuba, stopped, went back down the spine of Cuba, stopped, went back up the spine of Cuba. And we hadn't apparently, I don't know if it's top secret, but we haven't apparently seeded that one, but it sure raised suspicions. So who among us would want to make these kind of decisions? Then there was top secret military cloud seeding over Vietnam. When I was at the Congress 2 weeks ago now, we heard talk about maybe DARPA, the Defense Advanced Projects Administration, could do this, or the agency. And I think the most important thing is to keep this out in the open. Keep it out in peer-reviewed literature. Keep it out in circles where people can see it and think about it. And that's been sort of my effort. My other effort, as I said, I'm a historian. I'd like to see this become an interdisciplinary effort, an effort in which you get together not just technically trained people to think about the future of the planet and build a big lever, but historians, sociologists, all of our talents, people like the best example that comes to mind is somebody like Rachel Carson, who's, I don't know anybody that reads many of her technical things, but everybody reads Silent Spring. And so attitudes can change quickly towards the environment, and behaviors can change quickly. I think we can respond in this way. So history matters. It shapes our identity and behavior, and it's not just a celebratory thing. It's the sum total of our integrative collective past, and we need its perspectives to inform sound public policy, especially about things that are so speculative. History can provide scholars in other disciplines with detailed studies of past interventions by rainmakers, rain fakers, climate engineers who proposed these things, as well as a social analysis of all the treaties and interventions that have gone on in the past. And I think I'm sort of calling for a coordinated effort to do this across disciplines, across divisions of knowledge, not just technical disciplines. I'd like it to be international, not just UK, US, and Canadian, bilateral, trilateral. I'd like it to be intergenerational, because the kids and the grandkids are going to be involved in this. So I was tempted to bring my undergraduates down to Congress and have them testify instead of me. Climate change can be simple. We just want to do the right thing. We want to reduce our carbon footprint. We want to reduce our impact on the planet. We want to leave things for the future generations. But climate change is extremely complex, and it deserves lots of attention from all kinds of people, including the human dimension of historical studies. So I'm going to conclude by calling for basically a history that is informing public policy and an interdisciplinary effort that's emphasizing the international dimension, the voices that are typically not heard in most of the places I've been. I've almost always been the only humanist or the only historian or the only I'm a minority in that sense. Although I'm a white, Western, middle-class, middle-aged male, I'm trying to speak as the Lorax for some of this. And I think it has to be intergenerational. And with that, I'll thank you for your attention and conclude. Thank you.
We'll now hear from Alan Robach.
I'd also like to thank you for inviting me here, and it's been very nice so far. As was already said, this is an old issue and was brought up before, but we're talking about it now because in 2006, Paul Crutzen and Tom Wigley wrote articles that said, we're not doing anything about mitigation, and maybe we're going to have to use geoengineering as an emergency response. And people paid attention because Paul Crutzen had a real Nobel Prize, not like us who worked on IPCC. And people started thinking about it again. And later that year, I went to the same meeting that Jim went to where they couldn't control the temperature in the room. And David was there too. People were talking about geoengineering. I've worked on volcanic eruptions and climate my whole career, but not geoengineering. And I said, that doesn't seem like a very good idea. Maybe that's not a good idea. And I started writing down these reasons, and I ended up with 20 reasons why it might be a bad idea. So I'd like to go through those. They both said that volcanic eruptions demonstrate that you can put aerosols in the stratosphere and cool the climate, and it's safe. Pinatubo did that in 1991. But actually, volcanoes also do bad things, volcanic eruptions. They produce drought, ozone depletion, they affect solar power, and so they really don't prove that this idea is safe. The answer to this question is no. So here's my first 11 reasons. I'm going to go through them. I'm going to spend a little bit of time on one, but I'll go through the other ones quickly, don't worry. And so the first one is regional climate change. We did an experiment where we put in one Pinatubo eruption every 4 years. That's the black curve on here, 5 megatons of SO2 per year into the tropics. And the green line is the global warming we've seen over the last 120 years. We did it here. And we showed that if you do that, you can get cooling. If you put 10 megatons per year in, you can get more cooling. And so this brings, and we did it for 20 years, and then we stopped. So this brings up the question, what temperature do we want the planet to be? If it could work. There is no such thing as geoengineering, but if you could devise the technology. And who decides? Whose hand's on the thermostat? What if Canadians, Russians want a little bit warmer, Indians want a little bit cooler? Are we going to have geoengineering wars? Well, there's no governance mechanism now to control experimentation, let alone actually implementation. And then what would happen if you were doing it and something happened like this year in India? There was a drought in India just because of random variations of the weather, and people said it's caused by geoengineering, it's too dangerous, let's stop, or the equipment broke down. Then you'd get rapid warming, much faster warming than we would get if we did nothing. And it's the rate of change of climate that's dangerous, not the actual amount, because you can adapt if it changes slowly. In our experiment, we also found, although global temperatures went down, precipitation went down, it went down in specific areas. In the summer, the Northern Hemisphere went down over India and China, and so in these brown areas. And it wasn't just one bad monsoon. This was the average went down, and on top of that, there were even years with lower precipitation. So what can volcanoes tell us? Here's a photo I took of the Laki volcano in Iceland that erupted for 8 months along this fissure. And a friend of Benjamin Franklin's was in Cairo, and he wrote about his trip. He said the inundation of 1783 was not sufficient. That was the annual flood of the Nile River. And the Nile River water comes from farther south in a region where our model showed the precipitation would go down in Africa. And he said in 1784, the Nile again did not rise to the favorable height. So observations show after big eruptions, there is a reduction of precipitation in those areas. There was famine in India and China in 1783. It's called the Chalisa famine in India. After the Mount Pinatubo eruption, Trenberth and Dye showed that there would be a reduction of global precipitation. But if you look at a map of where it was, again, it was in India and China and other places. And so we can learn from this that even though you can control global climate, there can be large regional anomalies. So I worry you went over rapid warming when it stops. It couldn't be stopped rapidly if you wanted to. It doesn't solve the problem of ocean acidification because a fourth of all the CO2 we put in the atmosphere ends up making the ocean more acid. It produces ozone depletion. What about enhanced acid rain? I mean, if you put acid up in the atmosphere, it's going to come back out. And so we did a study with our model. We calculated how much acid would come out, and we compared it to how easily the system can deal with it. And this additional acid was 0.02 in these units, but It turns out it was orders of magnitude too small to be harmful. So even though you would get some additional acid, it wouldn't be that much. And so cross that one off. What about whitening of the sky but nice sunsets? Well, when you have a volcanic eruption, it produces a cloud in the stratosphere, and the sunlight comes through the atmosphere, and the shorter wavelengths are scattered to the side. That's why we have a blue sky. And that just leaves the yellow and the red, and if it goes through and reflects off the cloud, and you look up in the sky, you see this is like the drawing done after the Krakatoa eruption, 1883. It so impressed Edward Munch that 10 years later, when he did the Scream, he put a Krakatoa sunset in the background. I took this picture in Lake Mendota in Madison, Wisconsin, after the El Chichon eruption. But after Pinatubo, we had a meeting in Hawaii, and this is the instrument that measures radiation from the atmosphere, amount of sunlight, and I put my camera here in the shadow and looked up, and the sky was white around the sun. You get a lot more diffuse radiation because of this thin cloud there. They actually measure this in Hawaii, and so this is the amount of sunlight, direct sunlight, and this is the amount of sky light, 40 watts per square meter of blue sky. After El Chichon, you had a reduction of 175 watts per square meter of sunlight and plus 140 from the sky. So the direct sunlight was much less. The sky was much brighter. This was a 34% reduction in direct sunlight. One solution to global warming, one part of mitigation, which is the answer to this question, is focusing the sunlight and generating electricity. And these are a couple examples of systems that track the sun. There were some around in 1992, and this is data showing that after the Pinatubo eruption, there was a 34% reduction in the summer of the amount of electricity generation. So if you're trying to solve a problem with this technology, you might hurt one of the ways we're trying to solve it separately. So tick those two off. What about the effects on plants of this diffuse radiation? Actually, plants like diffuse radiation. They can grow faster, the stomates can stay open longer, and data show that there was more carbon dioxide taken up by the plants after Pinatubo and El Chichon than there would have been without that diffuse radiation. So it does, however, manipulate and change the biosphere. I decided that meant I would cross this off, though. Effects on cirrus clouds, we don't know yet. There would be environmental impacts of the whatever system you use to inject the aerosols. Here's the other nine reasons. What about unknowns? There might be errors, human errors. If any of you drove here, you probably wore your seatbelt. You didn't hope to use it, but just in case, you or somebody else could have made a mistake. And what about unexpected consequences? Donald Rumsfeld was right about one thing. There's unknown unknowns. We don't even know what we don't know. And so would you trust the whole planet to assist a technical system that might give you, it might be better than we thought, but it might be worse. And then number 14 is the moral hazard argument that David mentioned. If people think this is going to work, they will work less hard to reduce emissions. Should the military be involved? I mean, they have the technology to, in airplanes, or could it be used for military purposes? People would worry about that. What about the ExxonMobil Geoengineering Corporation? Whose interests would they have at heart? Because of some of the things Jim mentioned, because of cloud seeding in Vietnam and Cuba, there was a treaty written. It's called the UN Convention on the Prohibition of Military or Any Other Hostile Use of Environmental Modification Techniques. It's a really long name. But it prevents us from actually doing this without if it's going to hurt anybody. And so governance would have to be changed. And what about, I wrote down it could be tremendously expensive, but it turns out, as David said, it wouldn't be. And so we looked at different ways to do it with artillery or balloons or a tower or airplanes. And I'll just quickly go through this. So the National Academy of Sciences in 1992 had a report on geoengineering. They looked at artillery, naval rifles. They said the rifles could be deployed at sea or in empty areas where the noise of the shots and the fallback of expended shells could be managed. When they looked at balloons, they said the fall of collapsed balloons might be an annoying form of trash rain. So we looked at this, and it turns out with airplanes, existing airplanes or building new airplanes, it would be a few billion dollars a year, and balloons and naval rifles would be more expensive. I used to think $1 billion was a lot of money, but nowadays I realize that it's not that much in the big scheme of things, and so that's not a stopping point. So but there's currently no way to do geoengineering. No means exist to inject the aerosol precursors. Even if we could get them up there, we still don't understand how to make particles of the right size. If the particles are already there and you put more gases in the atmosphere, it's going to make the make them larger and be less effective. So, and even if it works, whose hand will be on the thermostat, and how could the world agree on a climate, and who has the moral right to actually change the climate on purpose that would affect all of the species, not just ours? So of the 20 original reasons, 16 I think are still serious. Three I crossed off, one I'm not sure. It would also not make astronomers happy to spend hundreds of millions of dollars putting telescopes on tops of mountains to get above the pollution. So I've listed the benefits. It would, if it could be done, it would cool the planet, reduce or reverse sea ice melting, ice sheet melting, increase plant productivity, beautiful sunsets. But there's 17 reasons why it might be a bad idea. And so each of these has to be quantified so that society can make informed decisions. We don't know yet. We don't know how important each of these are. We need a lot more research to look into it. So the American Meteorological Society has issued a policy statement on geoengineering. David and Jim and I were on the committee that helped write it, and I really support these recommendations. Enhanced research on the scientific and technological side, study of historical, ethical, legal, and social implications, and development of public policy options, governance that would promote international cooperation and restrictions on reckless efforts to manipulate the climate system. And so the Framework Convention on Climate Change, which helped give the title to this talk, the U.S., Canada, and all the other countries have agreed to prevent dangerous anthropogenic interference with the climate system. When this was written, they thought of dangerous anthropogenic interference as due to inadvertent effects on climate of greenhouse gases, but I think we have to pledge to include geoengineering in our pledge to prevent dangerous anthropogenic interference with the climate system. Thanks.
And our final presenter is Phil Raich.
Thank you all. It's a real pleasure to be here. Thank you to Lauren Trottier for holding the symposium and inviting us as well. I've got far too many slides to show you. I've realized that at this point in the game, and too much to tell you, so I'm going to have to skip over a lot of stuff. But maybe I've recognized as I've just watched the previous speakers, who I know quite well, that there were very few model results shown to you today, and so I'm going to take the opportunity to show you a bit about how models work inside, what we can do with them, and where their strengths and weaknesses are as well. I'm going to talk about two approaches to geoengineering, one of which was mentioned in one sentence on David's slide, the other of which has been discussed in a great deal of detail, or not a great deal of detail, but mentioned over repeatedly. That's the idea of introducing aerosols into the stratosphere for the purposes of geoengineering. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about the two approaches, and then I'm going to talk to you about some of the complications that we see in doing the modeling of geoengineering, where what we learn by using models and where we find deficiencies. And David has mentioned one slide in which he showed one of these new results which we've learned through the use of models. I'm going to skip over this stuff because I figured if Alan was hit by a bus, then I'd need to tell you about stratospheric aerosols, but I don't need to now. Instead, I'm going to jump to another way of or another method for doing geoengineering that hasn't been discussed in much detail, and that's through the use of clouds. Now, clouds play an important role in the energy balance of the atmosphere. The clouds that exist high up in the atmosphere, ice clouds primarily, actually act to trap energy in the atmosphere just the way CO2 does, and thus they act to warm the planet. But low clouds reflect energy. And thus, if you change low clouds in some way, you change the amount of energy that's reflected by the planet, and thus you can act, you can get them to cool the planet as well. So if we could increase clouds' reflectivity, we would be geoengineering. Now, in a sense, we actually are geoengineering today, although the critical component of geoengineering is deliberate or advertent modification of climate. What I show you in this figure, in the upper right panel here, is a scene, a satellite scene off the coast of France and Spain, the Bay of Biscay, of low clouds. And what you see when you look in that scene also are these streaks, so-called ship tracks, which are caused by the emissions of pollutants from ships. Through combustion processes. And the way in which those ships influence the clouds is interesting based on a fundamental property of clouds, which cloud droplets, the components of clouds, form around particles. Water vapor tends to condense on these particles, called cloud condensation nuclei. And the pollutants that are emitted by the ships introduce additional cloud condensation nuclei into the clouds. So the ship tracks there are one method of changing clouds, and the physics of it is pretty well understood. When you introduce more aerosols, you introduce more clouds or more drops into the clouds. You make each drop a little bit smaller than it would otherwise be because each drop is competing for the same amount of water vapor and thus make the clouds more reflective through some physics which I don't have time to talk to you about. In a study in 1990, Tony Slingo pointed out to the scientific audience that rather modest changes in cloud cover or cloud properties could really make substantial changes to the energy balance of the planet, and that with a 20% change in the number of cloud drops, or a 40% change in the cloud drop size, or a 12% change in the cloud cover, you could balance the doubling of the warming that was associated with the doubling of CO2. If you were to combine these effects, you can get by with a much smaller perturbation to the whole system. At least we think that's possible. So around the same time, a guy named John Latham suggested that we might deliberately do this. And what he noted was that sea salt particles were particularly good cloud condensation nuclei, but that they were too varied to produce predictable results. So what he suggested was that one start with seawater and make very small droplets of a very specific size and a very narrow range of sizes, which you would inject into the atmosphere. And then when those small droplets evaporate, they make salt particles, which mix up near the surface of the Earth, and when those particles are drawn into the updrafts of clouds, then they act to change clouds the same way the ship tracks do, only you would do it much more pervasively over the globe. Where might one seed these clouds? Well, we've done a little analysis, which I show on this map here. The areas in red are areas where if one were to seed clouds, they'd be particularly effective for changing the brightness of the planet. The yellow areas are areas where one could seed at certain times of the year and also, our models suggest, achieve significant changes to cloud cover, and the lighter blue areas would be less optimal. So if one was to do that, how could one change the planet? The top panel here shows a typical result from a climate model where we see warming indicated by the darker brown color in the northern polar regions. This is the typical response that climate models see, suggesting that there would be the maximum effect in the polar regions and particularly in the Arctic. If we see 20% of the ocean surface in the way that Latham has suggested, we reduce some of this warming, and if we seeded 70% of the globe, the green and blue colors there indicate we could actually overcool the planet. We'd also change the amount of sea ice. The top panel shows a similar plot where, in the presence of a doubling of CO2, a great deal of the summer sea ice goes away. If we seeded 40% of the planet, much of the blue areas have disappeared. Ice is returning with some geoengineering. And if we seeded 70% of the planet, we could actually grow too much sea ice in the polar regions, according to a model. Now, one of the things which Alan discussed with respect to the stratospheric aerosol geoengineering was the change in precipitation patterns, and this has also been of concern for the seeding of boundary layer clouds. And I'm showing you here two sets of results. In the upper right panel, this is a study done by a group in the United Kingdom at the British Met Office. And the purpley-blue colors that you see over the Amazon basin indicate a reduction of precipitation over the Amazon by 0.8 millimeters per day, which is maybe 10% of the precip that reaches the Amazon in the over the annual average sense. The lower panel here that I show adjacent to the thing saying change from geoengineering by seeding 20% of the ocean shows the precipitation changes for the model that I work with. And in that model, what we see is that there's actually a small enhancement of precipitation over the Amazon. So the point is that we're getting mixed signals from our climate models, and I wanted to point this out to you because we also, and I probably won't take the time to show it to you, see the same sorts of signals with climate models with respect to the stratospheric aerosol geoengineering. That one model will tell us one thing and another model will tell us another. Now, each of these experiments were done in slightly different ways, but potentially importantly different ways, and we haven't taken the time to sort this out yet. And one of the things which Alan has suggested and is under discussion right now is to attempt to do a really systematic job of trying to sort out what would be the effects of geoengineering by a very careful comparison of models, the same way we do assessments of climate change through an IPCC-like activity, or rather, potentially to participate in the IPCC activity. So I can see I've just got 1 minute, 3 minutes, 3 minutes now, and I'm through about half the talk, so I'm going to skip over an enormous amount here. Just to, I guess what I will do is spend, show you one more result, and then skip to my closing slides. And this one is basically reminding you that the picture that we've put together about how clouds work in this case is quite simple. The theory that suggests that you inject more aerosols, you make more cloud drops, and they become brighter is something that can be written on the back of an envelope. That's the way it was originally identified. We know it works in the real world, but we also know that there are an enormous number of other things which operate in real clouds that we don't capture very well in climate models. And I'm just going to show you one result and one modification of that theory. The idea is that there are sort of two potential effects of injecting more aerosols into the atmosphere on clouds. One of them identified at the top there is that more aerosol would lead to more drops. These drops won't bang together quite as easily as they would if they were bigger. And so there, you would get less rain. Now, this set of hypotheses would contribute towards making the planet brighter. But another alternate mechanism that could be operating in the atmosphere is that more aerosols lead to more drops, leading to smaller drops, but those small drops evaporate very easily in the atmosphere. And in fact, when you do very detailed calculations, very careful calculations that we can't afford to do in a global climate model, we see that both mechanisms are operating, and that for particular kinds of clouds, in this case what are called trade cumuli clouds, that when you're in a regime where there are not too many aerosols to start off with, that if you introduce a few more aerosols, that you make the clouds last longer and the planet brighter. But if you continue to add more and more aerosols to that cloud, then you get to a point where the aerosols start to introduce evaporation effects, and the cloud fraction goes down, and the planetary brightness or reflectivity goes down as well. So I'm going to have to skip over the stuff on the stratospheric aerosols, and I'm just going to close with one little story, I think, too, and we'll open it up for conversation. I guess it's just the take-home messages are that the world is incredibly complex, but even the models are very complex. As we look into the models, we're constantly surprised by what they do. We learn from them. There are many opportunities for improving them, and they'll be a more useful tool for doing geoengineering research and climate change studies when we do that. We're far from a time when we can depend on them. It requires some funding and systematic studies, as I've suggested. On the way here, I was reading an Atlantic magazine and on an entirely different topic where Mark Bowden, an author, was a journalist, was writing, lamenting over a dying profession, journalism, and talking about, and I've paraphrased a paragraph here, which I want to read over. Even an eager and ambitious blogger, which in this case is shorthand for him for somebody with an agenda, because he's drawn to the work out of political conviction, not out of curiosity, is less likely to experience the pleasure and finding of something new or arriving at a completely original, unexpected insight. Journalists can shake the preconception and poke holes in the presumptions. A preeminent goal is to provide a deeper understanding, aspiring to persuade, which requires at the very least as being seen as fair-minded and trustworthy by those, and this is the key, who are inclined to disagree with him. Now, what I was reminded of when I read these paragraphs that I've condensed is that, in fact, with just the modification of a few words, many of the things that he was focusing on and identifying as laudable goals for a profession were the things that I work on as a scientist as well. So what I frequently see with respect to geoengineering research are people who are discussing it with an agenda, a preconceived agenda in mind. Either it's the greatest thing since sliced bread, or it's the most horrible thing that one can do to the planet. On the other hand, for myself, my intention is to shake preconceptions and poke holes in presumptions, but really my goal is to provide deeper understanding, aspiring to inform you all. And this, again, requires at the very least being seen as fair-minded and trustworthy by those who are inclined to disagree with me. So I think this is a goal many of us in the science community have, and I'm going to close there.
Okay, so thank you very much to our presenters. And now what we're going to do is take approximately 15 or 20 minutes for the panelists themselves to ask questions of each other. And I think to do this in a somewhat systematic manner may be a good approach to do this. David was the first one to speak. He's the one that's listened the longest now without having to say something. So I'm going to suggest to David, if you have a question for your fellow panelists, if you'd like to raise one and direct it towards the individual or individuals you'd like to address it.
Sure. Maybe I'll start with one for Jim Fleming. Jim said that he wanted to see only experiments between consenting adults indoors. And that's a great way to think about it. But if you've actually worked on real atmospheric science experiments, you know that actually just working indoors with computer models tends to make you overconfident and disconnects you from the real world. And if you actually wanted to really understand this in any useful way, with any level of confidence and understand some of the things that really might go wrong, you'd have to do outdoor experiments. So Jim, by saying that we should only do indoor experiments, that's more or less saying we shouldn't develop the ability to do this. And I guess I want to push you a little bit and see if that's really your view. Let's say that we knew that the climate sensitivity was, 5 or 6 degrees C for a doubling, which means the roulette wheel is really landing on the unlucky spot, so that even where we are, we're in trouble. How do you feel about what we actually ought to do and how we ought to govern it?
That's a really big question.
That was it.
Because what we want to do is get to the point where we can formulate governance rules. And in the 50s, the NSF became a lead agency for recording outdoor experiments at a smaller scale. So I flew in instrumented aircraft and traced plumes of silver iodide around in my youth, and I decided that was too dangerous to do as a career because the plane actually crashed one time. But people were doing these outdoor experiments on a regional scale with silver iodide, and we had to keep a record of what was going on and try to make an inventory of that. My point is that I think we're just so far behind an outdoor experimental move at this point, as we see the complexity of the climate, as we see the inability of different modeling groups to agree or even try to agree, that the risk of having any regional scale thing, something like 20% of the ocean seeded off the coast of Peru, anything that's scalable or big enough to say, yes, we affected the global climate. I took Alan's diagram that he showed about geoengineering being turned on and then turned off, and he did that diagram, I think it was in 2008, but it was before 2008 was over. So what I did is I took the world temperature for 2008 and I plotted it on his chart, and it came out to be a geoengineering plot, as if we had already turned on geoengineering because of internal natural fluctuations that had taken the temperature down. So if geoengineering had been turned on and the natural fluctuations had taken the temperature down, then who was to attribute what we had done? How, if a cloud seeder can't tell if a cumulus cloud is going to rain or dissipate, or if you put too much dry ice into a cloud, you end up busting it up rather than accelerating its convection. So how in the world are you going to tell that your outdoor experiment worked? I'm not against research, but I think anything at that kind of scale, I was really spooked actually by the 20% figure, because you're in the trade winds off the coast, or the westerlies off the coast of Peru, and God knows they have enough precipitation issues there. So I just don't think it's ready for prime time, and I did support a lot of people calling for more modeling money and efforts to put these things together in computer world. But I think we're far short of going outdoors.
Can the rest of us?
Yeah, you certainly can. That's right.
I spoke up first, so I'll go. I'm interested in Jim's response, and I guess I think it's particularly pertinent, especially for the cloud seeding one. There's actually begun to be conversations about experimental work with cloud seeding, with perhaps the end goal of contributing meaningful information to our understanding of how clouds work and what their role is in the climate system. But it's very early days, and I guess I'd like to make the audience aware of it and also to hear Jim's response as well to the ideas of, for example, doing a lab experiment first to see, can we produce the cloud particles, the sea salt particles that we would like to introduce into the boundary layer? Could we then haul it out to the end of a dock and inject it into the lowest few hundred meters of the atmosphere and watch how those cloud drops evolve in space and time? And then could we monitor a single cloud or a single set of clouds repeatedly over a day, a week, or a month to look to see whether systematically introducing the perturbation and removing it allows us to understand whether we're able to influence clouds and whether our models, our detailed models, are sufficient to do this problem. So what I've outlined here is a kind of a methodical way of making progress on making sure we understand the climate system, a component of the climate system, well enough to even to take the next step to consider perturbing the climate system itself. I don't know where to draw the line there, and I'm interested in whether other people have a good idea of how to draw that line.
Jim, do you want to respond to that? Because you're
okay. Sure. Yeah, I was addressed directly. Yeah, I think the National Research Council in the U.S. had put out the 2003 report that included some of those sentiments about perhaps outdoor testing would help us understand better the cloud seeding effects because mainly of water issues all around the world. But my feeling was it's analogous to nuclear scientists asking for outdoor atomic testing. That if we could just perturb the system, and maybe if we perturb it a little bit or a little bit more, or there's a creep going on here, as we get to the point where we can get from the end of a dock on Scripps Pier to some layer where you could say, yes, we've affected the global climate. So I think that the permitting would need to be done. It would have to be a governance thing in place, which was the end of David's comment, which we're not even close to getting there yet. But I think there would have to be somebody that says, yes, you can go to the end of the dock. Yes, you. It's like the kids at night. Can I stay up for one more show? You know, can I have one more slice of pizza? And there's a creep going on as people are trying to do a little bit more and a little bit more and a little bit more. So I think there is a risk in going that direction. And certainly there are experiments going on out of doors, but we need to talk about this before they get too far along.
Alan, you wanted to join in.
I'd like to say, if we wanted to test the stratospheric aerosol scheme in the atmosphere, you'd basically have to do geoengineering. You'd have to actually implement it in order to test it, because the atmosphere is quite variable and noisy, and you needed to hit it with a large forcing so you can get a large enough signal amongst the noise. And you have to do it for a while. Nature does it for us small scale. There was the Sarachev volcanic eruption in Russia this summer. It put about 2 teragrams of SO2 in the atmosphere, about a tenth of Mount Pinatubo. Last year there was Kasatochi, about 1.5 teragrams. And so we couldn't detect any climate response because the weather's quite variable. There was a drought in India this summer. The monsoon started late, but it was before the Sarachev went off and had a chance to affect it. So we'd really have to hit it hard and do it for a long time. And if you start doing that, then there's a whole constituency, a whole infrastructure that's built up. And they said, well, if you want to stop it, you can't stop it. You'll get rid of more jobs. You'll affect the economy if you stop it. So it's not hard to think of other examples in the U.S. from the military or the oil industry where you can't change things the way they are now. You'll hurt us. And I testified in Congress with Jim a couple weeks ago, and the congressman from Nebraska said, you know, a lot of people grow a lot of cattle in my district. Are we part of the problem? And I said, well, yeah, you are, because they emit methane and a lot of CO2 in feeding them. And he wasn't interested in helping his people find another way to live with more peace with the planet. He just was interested in defending the status quo and trying to cut down what we were doing, and wasn't interested in creative solutions that would help everybody. And that happens all the time. And so I think if you start doing this at large scale, it'd be very hard to stop, whether it was good or not.
I am interested in finding ways for us to live more at peace with the planet, and so maybe it seems odd that I take this seriously. I've spent a bunch of time skiing around the high Arctic of Canada, and I really love it. And I don't like to talk about doing this, but I think this is a risk-balancing act. And the hard reality, we might wish it was differently, is that if we have no idea about how to do this, and we have, after all, no way to magically take all the CO2 out of the air, we have a serious problem. And serious problems mean you have to make hard decisions and hard trade-offs. A decision to do very little research over the next few decades may mean that when you actually came to do this, you do it in a hurried rush and botch it. So there are trade-offs in both directions. I think it's important to say that testing this doesn't mean some giant manipulating the whole planet scale. Even for stratospheric tests, some of the key uncertainties that we've discussed are how you actually make small particles in the stratosphere and what their effects on stratospheric chemistry is. And there's an enormous amount you can actually do with very tiny experiments. And I know this because I've been involved in these experiments that help determine the cause of the ozone hole. So we've flown the ER-2, a high-altitude regime military spy plane, but there's two that are instrumented for science. We've flown them through the plume of the Concorde and tried to understand in detail how that plume was affecting the environment. We could use exactly the same tools with very small amounts of material to learn something about how this would work. And the decision not to do it, I can understand the reasons that people think we shouldn't, and I respect them. I think there's some ones that are valid. I don't think we should do it quickly without some governance. But a systematic decision not to do it increases the risks later on.
Well, I think we should do experiments too, and I think we should do engineering experiments to see, can we build equipment to actually do it, and can we create particles of the size that would be effective at reflecting sunlight? But once you have a cloud there and you put more gas in, the particles would tend to grow and not be very effective at all, and you put a lot more and you just get larger particles. David was telling us earlier he has a way of making small particles even when there's particles there, but I don't know how to test that in the real world. So you can do small-scale experiments, but I'm not sure you can scale them up and have any confidence they would work on a large scale unless you actually do it.
Maybe what you'd have to do is do the experiment after a volcano that puts something up there.
So when's the next one going to be?
That's obviously the right question, but and it also reminds me of another thing, which is just to say that one of the things which all of us on the panel have discussed in the past is the fact that occasionally there are volcanic eruptions, and we're very poorly instrumented at this point to be able to do much to understand them at this point. It might be possible, for the purposes of understanding geoengineering better, to motivate the readiness or readying of a bunch of scientific instrumentation that would be capable of answering some of the questions that we all think are important with respect to understanding stratospheric aerosols, for example.
And it could help with governance, because if there was really an internationalized effort to get ready for the next volcano, that effort would implicitly engage some of the governance issues that are very hard here. I think the sooner we get started having a serious discussion, not just among scientists, not just among people from the rich countries, about how we govern this, the better. Because as we know, we're many technologies in our lives, from cell phones to what have you, technology moves faster than our culture's ability to cope with it. And so that says we need to get started early thinking about how the heck we manage this one.
In fact, the only instrument flying now that can measure stratospheric aerosols is a Canadian one. It's called OSIRIS. It's on the Odin, which is a Swedish satellite, and it looks sideways at the sun going through the atmosphere, can measure the vertical distribution of particles. We've used it for these recent eruptions. The U.S. had satellites, and they've gone, and there's no plans to put new ones up. I told the congresswoman from Florida with the Kennedy Space Center in her district that NASA could be part of the solution by helping us prepare for the next eruption. That made her very happy. I'm not sure if she's going to go give NASA enough money to do it, but it's a start. We really need even if we are not going to do geoengineering, we need to be able to monitor the stratosphere. So that's another part of the whole issue.
Okay, Jim?
Oh, good. I think this is significant because U.S. NASA is really looking into ways to operationalize some of their observations and have constant eyes in the sky. And Naveen and I were on a National Research Council panel that looked at the value of Earth observations from space. And I think you can do things. I'm not a Luddite. I'm not against experimentation, so I'm not against banning all experiments. But I think there has to be a rationale and a purpose and a smart way to do things, so that the value of understanding our home planet is really priceless, and we need to continue the capability internationally to continue to look down on the Earth from these positions and have things on the ground that can look at more or less these kind of natural events too. What I want to do is I'm a historian of science interested in public policy, but I'm also an STS professor. That means I could do anything I want to do, science, technology, and society. And
arts,
so
arts,
and so yeah, and so yeah, we're in the museum. So the idea here was to take a look at some of the language that's going on, which an STS students can actually do, and one of the issues that Alan brought up was whose hands on the thermostat. The MIT symposium 2 weeks ago had a giant hand coming out of the sky, reaching up into the heavens and turning a thermostat. It was a male hand. It was setting the temperature down below the Earth's average temperature, just visually reading the thing. And the thermostat had a visual of, it looked like Southwest Texas or something underneath the center of the thermostat. But as I looked closer, it was actually Roswell, New Mexico. And And visually and linguistically, we often, I heard at that meeting many people talking about, and I congratulate Phil for not doing this, talking about their model behavior and then leading directly into reality. The models show these results, so we are going to have to blank. And so looking at linguistics as well as looking at history is one of these interdisciplinary things we need to learn about. I wasn't quite so happy about striking out politics as if scientists have no politics. You just have good intentions because everybody has politics and everybody has every statement comes from a point of view. So what I'm saying is when Alan says we need to hit the stratosphere in a big way, that's using a military metaphor. Or when there's overheated polar bears trying to keep up a hose on those ice floes that you were showing, this is the Henning Wagon Breath cartoon from the New York Times. There's obviously sexually charged metaphors there that people in women's studies would go crazy over. How do you keep a hose standing up in the sky forever, you know? And so I find, I mean, I teach this stuff, and I'm extremely sensitive to language games and language claims and big levers and big leverages that come out of technological dialogue. And so I'm not asking a question, but I'm ranting. And I'll just see what kind of response I get.
I want to try one.
David.
I want to try one, which is to say that sometimes I hear Jim and I have been on a bunch of panels, so it's hard to know what she said. It sort of implied that the lever isn't there. And I think that there are lots of levers we really don't want to use, like the enormous lever that we have from knowing how to make nuclear weapons. There are lots of levers we don't want to use, like the levers that come from our ability to make very, very dangerous diseases that could communicate quickly. But I think we don't make better policy or governance by pretending that we don't have scientific abilities we actually have. I think that we have to be clear-eyed about the real abilities we have, which didn't come from studies of geoengineering. They come from the underlying science and technological advancement, whether you like it or not. And maybe we should try and rein it in and stop it. But I think we have to be really think about what we have, not about some other world that we don't have. I guess the final thing I'd say about geoengineering research is that we face a trade-off between two really bad outcomes. I think that one outcome is a kind of mad rush to have geoengineering be the flavor of the month, to have enormous resources put into it, and very rapid action and a removal of the focus from cutting emissions, and I think that would be a terrible outcome. I think on the alternative, we have a problem of it sort of continuation of the current world where it is de facto banned to do much and talk about it, where we have the sort of scientific elite thinking in the back of their heads, this is actually a get-out-of-jail-free card, but we don't do enough research to find out if it doesn't work. After all, one outcome research may be to find out that it really doesn't work very well. And I think the most dangerous situation is where a lot of people sort of secretly think it can work but don't actually do anything about it. That's a very, very dangerous situation. So I think it's a delicate balance between two extremes we need to achieve.
So I'd like to agree with David. Nobody suggests that this is a solution to global warming. Every responsible scientist says mitigation is the answer. And we know how to do mitigation, and we can do it now if there's the will. The technology exists. It's just people are refusing to do it right now. So geoengineering is not a solution. It's not going to save us from doing mitigation. Everybody says if we use it, it may be in the event of a planetary emergency, although we need a governance system to decide when do we declare an emergency and when do we say the emergency is over. Nobody knows how to do that. So do we have a plan B in our back pocket? We have a plan B in our back pocket in case of this, but the research is needed to know whether our pocket's empty or not. Is there anything in our pocket or not? And we don't know that yet, so we need to figure out if it can be done and if it would work so that we can make informed decisions.
Okay. At that point, it was interesting. At lunch, the question was whether we were going to have enough to discuss in between the end of their talks and when we opened it up to the public. So we are going to move to the open mic portion, but before we do that, I would like to invite the first question, which is traditional in the Lauren Trache Symposium, to Lauren Trache.
Hello. All right, I guess this thing is working.
Jim Fleming mentioned in his opening remarks, the quest for geoengineering is not totally new. In fact, one type of geoengineering, the attempt to try to make rain when there's drought, is quite an ancient human quest. You know, everybody's familiar with rain dances and shamans and so on from Aboriginal societies. And sometime in the last year or so, there was a big drought in Georgia, and the governor of Georgia led a large public group, it might have been at a football game or something, praying for rain. And within a couple of months, actually, the rainfall did increase significantly. But in terms of scientific efforts, I remember that I was around in the 50s and 60s, and I heard about some of these silver iodine seeding experiments that people were trying to do to make it rain. And so these efforts have been going on for quite some time. The Chinese, I think, this past year at the Olympics tried to do some stuff. I'm just wondering if there's been any serious attempt to model the effects of some of these cloud seeding experiments, and if there's any experimental results that or statistical results that show whether or not these efforts actually have produced the desired result, and if so, could this be useful? In other words, could it help solve drought problems in the real world, and could it also help advance the science of geoengineering?
I'm happy to try and respond. I'm frequently asked when I talk about cloud seeding about the utility of the studies that have been done in the past for this. And my response is generally that the effect that the people who have been seeding clouds have focused on in the past is the influence on rain hitting the surface and only on that. And so they have not attempted in the past to make measurements that would be relevant, particularly relevant to the to changing the reflectivity of the planet, our goal. But nevertheless, because the seeding process is certainly connected to the seeding process that we're talking about for these clouds, there should be things in that data which is useful. And my feeling is I have not seen a great deal of positive results from the rainmaking cloud seeding in the past. I think that what I also find interesting is my understanding from talking privately with colleagues, with Chinese scientist colleagues, is that the seeding that's going on in China is far more extensive than just to deal with the Olympics, attempting to keep rain off of the Olympics, but that in fact China has had a systematic seeding activity on an enormous scale for tens of years at this point in the game, and that the results apparently, well, are not discussed in the open scientific literature. So I don't know whether there is something to be gained from that. Within the United States and, well, other parts of the world, I don't think that there has been the kind of a systematic series of studies which of the sort which might benefit us for the geoengineering groups.
Despite the enormous hype in the 1950s, cloud weather control by cloud seeding basically hasn't worked. I mean, it works marginally in some places, is my impression. And so you might say, if we can't do that, why the heck could we possibly think we could control the global climate? But there's an important difference between climate and weather. You might also ask the following question. In fact, when I talk to people who are climate skeptics, I often get the following question, which is, we can't predict the weather more than 2 weeks in advance. Why should we be able to predict the climate 100 years in advance and say that there's a problem with putting CO2 in the air? And the answer is, they're just very different kinds of problems. Predicting the weather is what a mathematician calls an initial value problem, where you need to know the way the world is now and predict the exact whirls of the atmosphere sometime in the future. Predicting climate, forgetting geoengineering, predicting the climate effects from CO2 is more what we call a boundary value problem, where you want to see how the whole system reacts. You can't predict everything, but you want to see the average reaction. And in fact, we think we have more confidence predicting the climate 100 years out than the weather a month out. And in the same way, in some ways, crazy as it may sound, I think we're more confident that if we really wanted to engineer cooling, which wouldn't be just a cooling, it would have lots of side effects by putting reflective materials in the stratosphere, that we would be able to do that and get a big effect, than through cloud seeding, which, at least for making rainfalls, largely deals with the fact that weather is very variable and with this underlying rob Peter to pay Paul problem, that you've only got a limited amount of moisture to move around. And one of the central problems with cloud seeding, even when it does work, is that you tend to pull water from one place to another. You don't make more water. So they're very different animals.
I was flying around in the NCAR glider. This is it's meant to be non-obtrusive. We were getting pulled up into cumulus clouds to look at what was inside of them. But the locals in Colorado, this is in the 70s, thought we were cloud seeding. So they threw a Molotov cocktail into the hangar. It burned up the wing of the NCLAR glider, and we had to go home and kind of look at our data and stuff. And so my point is that it changed attitudes. The action their perception of intervention changed human attitudes. This is what Eliza Leslie was talking about when Espy said maybe he could control the weather. She immediately, in 1841, said, well, nobody would be happy with that. There would be tensions and problems with that. And so so it's the risk of doing that at all. The ancient rainmakers you mentioned, the traditional rainmaker, was a central figure, sometimes a rain queen. Africa had rain queens. They had inherited lineages of people who made sure that the people were prosperous, and that when the rains came, the rain queen would make sure it was equally distributed. In ancient Korea, they had an emperor who was the Buddha on the earth, who was in charge of heaven and earth. He was in charge of making sure everybody had the rains and things. Of course, he wanted all the production of his kingdom on his table, but it was a symbolic offering because he wanted to make sure the people had things too. And they actually established a measured rain gauge network in Korea back in at least as early as the 15th century. So way ahead of Western things. And so and in the Native American tradition, the rainmaker was chosen by the rain cloud. It was the brave who was up there importuning the weather to provide the rain for the tribe on the day that it rained. It was considered for life, the magic shaman, and he had a free ticket. So we changed the whole meaning of our relationship to the sky, and that's part of what my book's about. It's about hubris and intervention and trying to do too much through technology without having enough of your sort of perspective here that I think history provides.
And rainmaking is full of charlatans trying to get rich from it, too. And so that teaches us about in geoengineering, you want to be sure people are doing it because they're curious and wanted to figure out how the system works and not how they can make money from it. Irving Crick was a professor at Caltech, and he sold rainmaking equipment. He went to farmers in the Midwest and said, look, here's a silver iodide generator. When a cloud comes over, turn it on, and then the silver iodide will be lifted up into the cloud and make rain. And it's guaranteed. You only have to pay me if it rains. So he'd wait till it rained, and people would send him money. And they tried to fire him, but he had tenure, so they ended up closing the meteorology department at Caltech to get rid of him.
And there will be geoengineering charlatans, too, because any big enterprise has charlatans and nonsense.
I hope Alan's not giving the provo any particular ideas on how to do budgetary management. Okay, now I'd like to switch to the public question section. There are a number of people lined up at the microphones already, so I would, to be able to handle as many questions as we possibly can, I would ask the questioners to limit themselves to one question and to make that question short, and also to avoid preambles to the question. So I believe this gentleman was the first one at the microphone, and then we'll go back and forth across the room. So, and who do you direct your question to? So.
My question is principally directed to James Fleming, but I'd like to hear other opinions as well. It seems like one thing that all of you agree on is that governance and management and international agreement is essential to doing any kind of geoengineering responsibly. And that, of course, is exactly the same obstacle that doing anything about climate change in general is hung up on. So, it seems like we're just switching from one thing that's hung up on governance to a different thing that's hung up on governance, and what we really need to do is find a way to fix the governance problem. So I'm wondering if James Fleming or others have a perspective on how we can grease the wheels of that governance problem from a historical perspective, perhaps on how we've solved prior problems.
Yeah, sure. Thank you for the question. We've heard many times, and I think we heard it tonight, that that Paul Crutzen opened up this new era of geoengineering discussion. But one story I didn't tell you was how John F. Kennedy did that. And he wanted to see international cooperation and things like, he said, let's go to the moon and do the other things. And part of the other things was climate control. Back in 1961, he talked about this. And so we've been thinking about this, but not getting our heads around governance very well since the, well, of course, Kennedy wasn't able to finish his administration. But there's a new book coming out that argues from a major space historian that we might have gone to the moon with the Russians bilaterally had Kennedy not been assassinated. So there's historical lessons in the past. There's things like the peaceful use of outer space. There's things like the World Weather Watch. We're now re-invoking the World Weather Watch for international satellite cooperation because the U.S. does a poor job at operationalizing its research satellites. We're good at new discoveries, but we don't like to maintain monitoring satellites. So we've been drawing on the notion of the World Meteorological Organization, the World Weather Watch, the humanitarian use of science, the way that the United Nations Environmental Program goes forward. I think we have some good, strong governance things on the law of the sea. We have things like nuclear test ban treaties. We have things that we need to systematically look at in order to get our governance chops in order for this thing that doesn't exist, as I said, this geoengineering, before we get too far along the creep axis here. Also, and this is fundamental, I don't think that in general we haven't done a good job with Kyoto. We haven't done a good job. We're getting ourselves ready for a disappointment in Copenhagen, or at least a delay. And I don't think we're very good at international governance in general, although there are some shining examples, the Montreal Protocol. Hey, it's Montreal. That's considered a great success. But what I do think is that attitudes can change quickly. I think that tipping points can be social, things like smoking in public, things like wearing your seatbelt that was talked about. There's things that people just agree. You know, you look at the old black and white movies, you say, my God, they're all smoking. Or look at how dingy New York City is in that movie. You know, and so I think that people can change suddenly, or attitudes can change dramatically. And we need to get more, let the guys over there in Geneva do it for us, or let the Congress do it, or let the House of Commons decide. And we need to have more behavioral and attitudinal changes, which I think the humanities can help open up. That's why I mentioned Rachel Carson's evocative stuff rather than her scientific stuff.
Okay, we'll take a question here.
Yes, hello. My name is Diana Bronson. I'm with the Et Cetera Group, an NGO that monitors new technologies, including geoengineering. We've done a number of reports. They're on our website. I'd be happy to give that to anyone who wants. I would really like to push David Keith on the question of experimentation and governance. I think we heard pretty clearly from James Fleming that there should be no experimentation outdoors. It seems Alan Roebuck has said certainly no stratospheric aerosol engineering. It's too dangerous. There's too much unknown. You want to move to outdoor experiments. You think governance is important, but it doesn't sound like you want the rules of the game established clearly before that goes ahead. And I'd like to hear your response to that, because I do think those rules need to be established certainly before any experimentation goes forward. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your question. I think we need the rules to be established as we work on the game. Generally, I think developing serious international governance for this is the highest priority, and I personally have put a lot of effort into getting people together from the social science, from the foreign policy communities to think about how we would do the governance. So I think it's crucial. I think we need to develop norms of behavior and norms of behavior that end up having the weight of law about things like
transparency. I think when we're talking about these high leverage technologies that manipulate the whole planet, we need to have a norm that says no intellectual property will be held, and that there should be some real clarity about absolute transparency. And I think that's different for these sort of manipulate the world technologies than for sort of local technologies like wind turbines that we might use to fix it. We need to get that distinction clearly. I think the only place I probably differ with Diana is I think that if we moved very quickly to a UN-level treaty this early in the game about thinking about the underlying science, the results probably wouldn't fit the science very well, one way or the other, because we would be unclear about what we were prohibiting and what we were not prohibiting. So I see governance more happening from the bottom up than from the top down, but I absolutely agree we need serious governance, and the governance must engage what happens with early experiments.
To the right, Mike.
I think the warning about one question was directed at me when Nigel saw me walk up, so I'll keep it to one. My question, first, I really appreciated the comment about engaging the masses and individuals on behavior. I also am wary of the technological challenge that we're facing, because I don't know if I agree whether we have the technologies existing. It's a matter of deploying it. But I think how you make a decision between those two things is how you measure our progress. But I'm enormously concerned at going with one unit of measurement, to kind of guide our decisions on are we successful or are we not, because I feel like there's so many different implications. It's a really, really complicated problem. Could anyone who wants to talk about how we measure our progress and what the implications would be in terms of weighting priorities between the number of abatement strategies that we have?
For abatement, we measure our progress by reducing emissions. And I think there are trade-offs, because anything we do to reduce emissions is going to have some local impacts. So whether you're talking biofuels or wind power plants or coal plants with CO2 capture or nuclear power plants, they're all going to have some local impacts that are bad and good, depending on which side of the fence you're on. But I think for abatement, it's pretty easy. We need to cut our emissions. We need to cut our emissions effectively to zero over a human lifetime or shorter than that. And I think we have lots of technologies available right now that could allow us to do this at a price we could easily afford. So thinking about things like large-scale wind power, large-scale nuclear power, in sunny places, central station solar, and coal with capture, these are things you could deploy essentially now with technology we have in hand, and you could decarbonize the electricity system, 40% of global emissions, over a matter of decades at a cost that's less than or about the same as we spend on the military. A cost that would certainly not have a big impact on the overall size of the economy. And the fact that we haven't done that represents a phenomenal lack of will to confront a serious problem.
Two of our other panelists moved forward to the microphone. I don't know whether...
Go ahead.
No? Okay.
Well, sure.
I've been trying to read the body language on the panelists.
Well, go ahead. You're hotter than
I'm what? I'm hotter?
You're closer.
I think the way you have to measure progress is by what we call radiative forcing, what the amount of energy that we're trapping or that we're adding to the system that causes climate change. The weather and climate system is so variable that you can't attribute a particular hurricane or a particular drought to weather variability or to climate change, but we can measure the amount of greenhouse gases or the amount of energy reaching the planet. Thinking of the Montreal Protocol, what it regulates is ODS, ozone-depleting substances. We know that these chlorine and other halogen chemicals have started to go down in the atmosphere because we've stopped emitting them. And even though 1 year might have a big ozone hole or not, we still know that that's progress because we know in the long term our theory and explanation of past observation shows that we're on the right path, independent of interannual variations. So what we measure is CO2 concentrations. We measure, if we do geoengineering, we measure the amount of particles and the change of radiation, and then we have confidence that the response will, will be oscillating, but will be responding to that.
Okay. In the big picture,
We feel that mitigation is the way to go. There's that or in the title of the symposium. We like mitigation, but there's problems there as well. Adaptation has been a bit under discussed. In fact, at least in the U.S., the environmental movement didn't want to admit that adaptation might be necessary. But there is more discussion of that. We're here talking about geoengineering, but there actually came up a fourth way of cutting emissions, and that's the way that the Soviet Union did it. They became the former Soviet Union. And so one of my good colleagues, Mike McCracken, who we all know, he came to Colby recently and he said, you know, the one outstanding experiment that we've never shown to be successful is a totally a robust decarbonized economy. Can we do that? Can we have an economy that's not running fast, but is not running on fossil fuels? And I think that's an interesting kind of experiment that I'd like to see go forward, probably out of doors, and can have everybody try it. And so mitigation, which we consider to be a good thing, can be a bad thing. We were universally assuming in the U.S. that the Midwest biofuel bubble that was out there about 3 years ago was just a totally good thing, but in Congress, they were pushing it.
I wouldn't say it was uniform.
Yeah,
nobody
in the United States.
Nobody thought that was a good idea.
You're supposed to be a historian.
It took some contrarian voices to.
Congressman from the Midwest thought it was a good idea.
Yeah. Okay. I'm improvising. But there were some serious academic concerns, and then it spread, fortunately, to become a general concern that overuse of biofuels would be bad for food supplies and bad for emissions as well. And so there are dumb mitigation ideas that are going forward. So mitigation is a real big basket, I guess is my point. And that we can't just simply invoke mitigation and nod sagely and move on, but we have to look at what is specifically being proposed. And so I guess recently we've been talking less and less about big G geoengineering and more about different things, attitudinal and small E engineering kind of things that could be done and should be done and make reasonable sense for more and more people. And if you keep it at a political level, if you demonize left versus right in climate change issues and make it a national issue, you're not going to get the job done. So we need to find ways to depoliticize it or go beyond partisan politics in it and try to get to a place where that middle path, where the things that the people want to do or they want to do better, and then if we overdo it in something, like the biofuels thing I think was overdone, then we can back off and take a different path. So we need flexibility, and we need to have not an assumption that one of the big categories, like nature, it's such mitigation is such a big basket that we have to look under the hood and see what details are we really talking about.
Okay. What I'm going to ask is we have two last questions that we do. So the two people that are on either side by the mic, I'll ask you to do that. I'll ask you to keep your questions very short. I will point out we're having a reception afterwards that the speakers will be outside, that everybody is invited to, that you can come to. So the last two questions, if you could keep them very short, it'd be appreciated.
Okay. I'm concerned with the question of time. On the one hand, we're told that mitigation, even in the best-case scenario, if you had problems, if solved the problems of governance and millions of people cooperating, will take too long to deal with climate problems. On the other hand, we're told that the uncertainties and variables are so complex in geoengineering that it will take decades and decades and decades of research. So it seems to be, in plain English, that we're screwed either way. So how does one manage to get out of this catch-22 situation?
I'll ask the panelists for a short answer to that.
Let me. I think it would only take one decade of research of geoengineering to know what shape we're in with geoengineering, not decades and decades and decades. And so one decade of geoengineering research should really make it clear whether we have the technology and what the benefits and costs would be, not many decades.
We don't know all the unknowns. You can't say that.
No supplemental.
Let me talk about successes. We've heard a lot of talk about failures. Since President Johnson got that report about climate change, we've done nothing on that topic,
But we've had amazing success in the rich world solving a bunch of environmental problems, from the persistent lead from organic chlorines, DDT, to ozone. We've cleaned up the water and the air. None of them perfectly. They've all been messy, but we've made enormous progress. And I believe we can make enormous progress cutting CO2 emissions with technologies we have in hand. There will be problems. There will be mess. There will be profiteering. This is the real world. But we can make huge progress cutting emissions. We must do it, whether or not we learn how to geoengineer. And I think that I just think defeatism is silly. I mean, we've had huge, huge success before. We can do it again on this one. And the success won't be perfect, but that's just the world we live in.
Okay, last question here.
All right, so this is for all of you. What impact will geoengineering have on our health? If aerosols form sheets of clouds to block the rays of the sun, how will this impact our ability to intake vitamin D? How would this affect our immune systems, and how would this affect our crops?
Well, one quick response is just to say that the perturbations that we're talking about are a very, very small perturbation on the system
globally average.
And there are not too many people who live under marine stratocumulus, for example, as well. There are potential, if we're talking about a local effect.
I'm worried about the unknowns mostly. Yeah. I think that if you reduce sunlight by 1% or 2%, people have looked at what that does for crop productivity. It turns out to be pretty small. For human vitamin D, it would be irrelevant. I think the things that I really worry about are things we haven't thought about, that somehow we'll put something in stratosphere and have some unexpected impact on some stratospheric chemistry or have some odd feedback that we don't anticipate that's terrible. But at least the answer to the question you asked about vitamin D or total crop productivity seem to be very, very unlikely to be problems.
The other thing to just add to that is to say that we know, for example, with respect to stratospheric aerosols, that the Earth can survive quite large perturbations from the records of volcanic eruptions, and we're talking about smaller than that, although the difference is that we're talking about applying the perturbation over decades instead of injecting some aerosol and then having it go away in a year or two. So the long-term response of the ecosystems could be different from what we encounter with volcanic eruptions.
I would just say that none of us are really specialists in that, but that should be one of the areas of active research. We need to involve people who are experts at that, agricultural scientists, ecologists, give them scenarios of changes of precipitation and sunlight and temperature, and work with them to investigate that. Those are questions we have to look at.
Thank you.
Okay. We'd like to bring this symposium to a close with a number of thank yous and then invite you all to the reception outside. First and foremost, I'd like to thank Lorne Trace and his family for their extremely generosity in being able to support this symposium and as he has done in the past symposiums. I'd also like to thank the Dean's Office of the Dean of Science for all the people that worked in the background to be able to put this together. It takes a lot of hours and days to be able to put this thing together. The original idea for this symposium and the topic came from the young scientists that we have hired at McGill University in the Earth System Science program. And they are members of, collectively, the Departments of Atmospheric and Ocean Sciences, Department of Earth and Planetary Sciences, and Geography, and it's through their efforts that this came about. And finally, I would like to thank our panelists who have David, Jim, Alan, and Phil, who have taken time out of their extremely busy schedules. We are not the only place that is interested in this topic recently, and they have been extremely involved in numerous commissions, testifying in front of Congress, working with the Royal Society, and on the reports that are coming out at the present time. So I'd like to thank them very much for their participation, and we're honored that you came to McGill to be involved in this symposium.
Two last bits of business. You are all invited to a reception that will take place just outside the door here, and the speakers will be around for approximately an hour afterwards. And if you have additional questions, we do have a round table that is scheduled for tomorrow afternoon from 1 until 2:30. Unfortunately, one of the speakers will not be with us, but the other three will be. It is in Leacock 232, which is immediately above us, and you are all welcome to come to that and participate in a question and answer period of the round table. So I invite you to the reception.